Dragonfly. Is Representative Nikolai here?
She's running a little late, but she'll be here shortly.
Or her staff?
We have people on from Antioch. Do you have a list of folks from Antioch?
How soon will she be here? Shall we go on to the next one?
Why don't we go to the second, the boot camp bill first?
Yeah, okay. Are you ready with House Bill 2, Representative Willis?
Yes, Madam Chair. As you know, we addressed this last week, and the administration and I worked on a few changes to address some of their concerns. I don't know, is Jerry Schreiner here?
Yes.
Madam Chair, could you bring Jerry up?
Sure.
For the record, my name is Jerry Schreiner with the Department of Corrections.
There were several changes made, and I'll just speak in general for starters. We had to make some changes in the title as a result of making changes in the bill. Under the original bill, in sections 1 and 2, it allowed the court to impose boot camp as part of sentencing. These two sections were deleted, and they were deleted because it was not my intention that the boot camp be used as a bargaining chip for defendants, and this being deleted would let the candidates for the camp be selected by the Department of Corrections itself. There was a new section added that allows discretionary parole after the successful completion of the program. That's in Section 2. And in Section 4, under the boot camp program, there was some language changes made. Administration also was concerned about references to the alternative, the term alternative boot camp. The department raised some concerns over the use of the term alternative when referring to the contracting out provisions with regard to the program. And to address these concerns, the term alternative has been deleted and, where necessary, replaced by the term contract. Essential provisions concerning the contracting out for boot camps has not been changed, so we could still contract this out. And another change was that we added 26 years of age cap back into the bill, so it would be for those 26 and under. And then there was another change made with regard to the Boot Camp Advisory Board. It deleted the Superior Court judge as a member of the Boot Camp Advisory Board because that person would not be needed on that particular advisory board. So that essentially has been the changes that were made, and perhaps Mr. Schreiner could elaborate.
Thank you.
Yes, would you like to talk about the bill a bit?
The department is in favor of this bill. We feel that the sponsor has been very cooperative in including some of our concerns. There were a couple of things that we don't necessarily agree on. For example, we might have liked to had the age range a little higher. We think maybe 26 is a little restrictive, but then on the other hand, in the discussions, it was pointed out that if if that turned out to be true, that could be changed at a later time, perhaps next year or after the facility had been in operation for a year or so. So that, we don't consider that a problem. With reference to the contracting issue, that change was made, and I did want to make it clear that the concern was not that we're opposed to contracting. That was not the issue. Our concern was that the way the language was, we thought that it could be interpreted in such a way that the department might operate its own boot camp, and someone could, from reading the language, say that you also have to operate an alternative, privately operated boot camp, and we could end up operating two of them instead of one. So that was what we wanted to avoid, but we're not, it wasn't our intention to limit it to a state-run facility. We would still be open to contracting that facility. When I was here, when I testified briefly on this committee before, I said that we were getting some computer modeling program that would give us some information about how we might best staff and operate this facility, how long people should be in it, what sort of parole conditions should be on them. And I have that. I've run a couple of scenarios on it. It looks like it might be real interesting. And it's real clear that there's some things that, depending on what one's goals are, there's some things you should and should not do. For example, a change that the sponsor has made to eliminate entrance into the program as a condition of parole seems to be borne out by the model as well as by other people we've talked with. This term of art of net widening is quite a concern, and we see this boot camp facility as an opportunity to apply a new idea to reducing prison population, not to expanding it. And that's a critical factor. If you intend to reduce prison population with a boot camp, you need to be very careful that the people who are going into the boot camp would have gone into prison otherwise. That you need to be extremely careful that you not allow this to become a plea bargaining tool to expand your prison population rather than reduce it. So we really appreciate that those things have been done in the bill. At this point, we're still gathering data about how many people in our system might qualify for this program in terms of offense and age group. I think I have that stuff on my desk now. I haven't had time to analyze it. And as this bill moves through committee into judiciary, I suppose particularly, we should be able to have a lot more detail about the population and how the program might operate. But I guess that's really all I have to say at this point. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
I have a question, and my question is the economics of it. And isn't any of your models or things, was there any economics in your models?
The model does not contain, does not specifically contain anything with respect to economics. However, I think that we will be able to extrapolate from that some numbers about cost savings. In other words, what the final result of this model is, it tells you, given the conditions that you have entered in or that I have entered in with respect to the kind of population, it will tell you whether the result will be a net increase or a net decrease in the prison beds in your system and how long it will take before that effect is realized. For example, if a boot camp program is going to result in a net reduction of 50 beds in your prison system, it also tells you how long that's going to happen. For example, one of the scenarios I ran using 75 beds and my best information about the population that we had, it would take approximately 2 years of operation of the boot camp to realize a 100-bed reduction in the existing prison population. And from that, I think we can then make some extrapolations about what the cost savings are. However, I do need to say that we're still doing some research, but it seems clear from talking with other people and from reading the research that I have that the daily operation of a boot camp facility is more expensive than normal prison population, more than more than the normal prison operation. Savings result in that they're designed to be short-duration programs, and the cost savings result from your ability to move people into the system, provide the training, the punishment, the reformative factors, the rehabilitative factors in a much shorter period of time with the same or hopefully even lower recidivism rates, and the net, that's the source of the net savings to the systems where they've been successful in using these. But finally, I do need to point out that it's very clear from everyone who's run boot camps that simply running a boot camp, and most of them are sort of, what can I say, militaristic sort of operation with a lot of physical training, a lot of marching, a lot of discipline kinds of things. And it's very clear that simply doing that is not effective in terms of recidivism. In fact, these people may return to the system as probation or parole violators at a higher rate than they would have had they gone to your regular system. So the net savings is zero, or maybe you've even lost money. It's important to tie these programs with other rehabilitative programs, but they can be applied in less restrictive settings once the person has successfully completed the boot camp. For example, someone who successfully completes it has a higher likelihood of then going on to successfully complete a substance abuse treatment program or an educational program. So you, in a short period of time, you've applied a certain amount of learning and discipline to an individual, and if you immediately follow this up with other programs where that same kind of personal application is important, everything as you go down the line is more successful.
Okay. Go ahead, Representative Porter.
Thank you. I'm sure you've looked at the federal model that the National Guard has had to employees, as opposed to a period of discipline and then a follow-up program. They combine it. They do the GED work at the same time as going through the actual boot camp, just like a regular boot camp. It's not just marching, having gone through one or two.
That's right, and I think the way I said that's somewhat misleading. It's that those things, in part, do go on simultaneously. For example, if the program is 150 days long, we would not wait 150 days of physical training before we did anything else. Those things go in parallel, yes.
What is your, I think I have a couple of questions. Is the bill the same in terms of the duration, expected duration of the boot camp?
Yes, it's.
And that is.
It would be 150 days, I think, what we're contemplating at this point.
In that is within the purview of a misdemeanor, municipal misdemeanor sentence, could you accept misdemeanor prisoners from municipalities?
You could accept misdemeanor offenders. And it might be a good idea. It's one of those things you have to be careful about what your goals are. If your goals are to reduce your overall service of time in in institutions, you want to be careful that you are not taking misdemeanors who might have otherwise only gotten 100 days, for example. But certainly there's nothing that would stop misdemeanor offenders from taking part in the program.
Just one more, if I could.
Representative Porter.
The federal youthful offender designation, that does go up to 25 or 26, isn't it?
I'm not sure about that. I don't.
I think it did. Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Can you tell me, we look at the costs of hard beds versus, say, halfway houses, and there's a significant drop in costs. You've indicated that boot camps actually could cost more than hard bed prisons. Could you explain why that would be?
The operating costs are high because it takes a great deal of staff to. Some places have referred to these as shock incarceration programs. Well, I don't particularly like that term. I think the meaning of that is that if someone is sentenced, for example, and goes to Lemon Creek or any other institution, they go in, they're going with a normal population there, they get involved in work, they do the various things, but it's sort of a daily fairly easy, routine kind of thing, and there's a normal number of staff there to provide custody and security. With a boot camp type of facility, the intent is to apply a great deal of intensive work and pressure, if you will, to the inmate. And the requirement of that is a high staff to inmate ratio, much higher than we have in an institution. And the reason is not for security and custody, not because these would be dangerous offenders, but because you're doing a great deal more personal work with them. So the operating costs are higher. The cost of the physical plant is probably less because these are medium to what would be considered medium to minimum custody prisoners. They're nonviolent offenders. So you probably don't need to build or remodel a facility to the high level security standards that we would for a violent offender, for robbers, murders, and so forth. So you save some money on the capital side, but the operating is expensive.
And let the record reflect that Representative Robinson is here. I guess that the question that I have is, in the declining revenues, you know, it'd be very difficult, I think, to get more money to do this, but I think the real advantage of this whole thing is the recidivism, and you indicated that that may or may not have a, you know, in your models that you have. Do you have any kind of percentage or whatever relating to that?
It's available. I don't have it. It's in the mail, if you will. We're gathering data from programs that are operating, and at this point, the best I can say is that the reviews on recidivism are mixed. Some programs have been quite successful. Others don't seem to show any difference. And what we're trying to look into now is, what are the factors that have made some programs successful while others have not been? And so I can't give you a straight answer. I know there are differences. I know some have worked, some haven't, but I don't really know why.
The other question that I had is on a volume basis. And you know, this is being a small state, we might have, compared to other states, a small number of people that qualify for boot camp, whatever that definition is of treatment is. And so I was early on, my question on economics was, is there an area of size or amount or volume of prisoners going through the system that would be the ultimate in cost savings? You know, I didn't know whether there was anything like that.
I suppose there is. The general thing that I think that you've alluded to is that larger can be more efficient, and we have a limited number of people who could go into this program. At this point, it looks to me like, for example, in our prison system right now, there are 240, 235 people who would qualify for this program according to the bill that you have before you. I don't know how long these people's sentences are, and I don't know what the turnover would be. So I suspect at this point that given our population, we would be running a program somewhere between 50 and 100 people. In terms of efficiency of operation, it would probably be better to be able to run one that was 200. I don't think that we're going to be able to do that. However, in my at least preliminary work with the model that we have, even a 50 or 75 bed program, if recidivism rates are kept low, and I don't unreasonably low, for example, discretionary parole revocation rates, I believe, are somewhere around 25% or something like that. And if I plug that number in to this program, we can still come up with a net savings over about a 2-year period. So I think we can operate effectively if we design the program well and we're careful with the folks that we put in it, and that we consistently apply the other things that we know have to be done, which is treatment, education, particularly substance abuse treatment. If we short-circuit those things, if we don't do the whole job, the program won't work. It's probably a real money loser, no matter how big or how little it is, if we don't do all of those things. So, yes, we're concerned about the smallness of the program. We have people in the department now looking at how we would, if we were to pull these 250 people, for example, who are scattered throughout 14 different institutions, you don't get any net savings. It's not like you can close a wing here because 10 of them are here and 15 are someplace else. And so we're trying to look at how we can reconfigure population if we were to do this in some way that we actually create more beds for other folks. From the federal standpoint, from new federal crime legislation, and there is some federal money available for construction of these programs. I haven't found any that's available for operation. There's money available for construction, and the federal programs are based on the theory that they want states to institute programs aimed at minimum medium custody prisoners with the theory that more dangerous offenders have greater certainty of being locked up for more certainty of being locked up and locked up for longer periods of time. That's the reasoning behind the feds getting involved in funding these kinds of programs. And we think that works, but it is difficult with our small population to.
This is typical with a lot of the things we have to do to here in Alaska, and particularly we hear about the high cost of government as example per capita in the state, and when you have a large state and small people, you have more people, it would probably not cost us any more than it does right now. So that was why I had that question. I have one question of Representative Willis first, and then I'll get to Representative Porter. Earlier there was a big capital fiscal note in here and another fiscal note, and I don't see that. Am I missing it out of my packet, or do you have...
That was in the original packet.
Okay.
$5 million is what...
$5 million, yes.
Okay. How come I don't have that?
I don't think it's a nine either.
I know I had it before. Oh, yes, anyway, I'll continue to look for it. Representative Porter, you have something else.
Thank you. You may have already looked into this, but if you haven't, and need some time, by the time it gets to judiciary, I'd be interested in finding out if there's any possibility of partnering with the existing program, the boot camp program that the National Guard has. Is there any ability to combine efforts or use their facilities or people or expertise or whatever? I happen to have monitored a couple of their boot camps, and their program, of course, is aimed at younger people who are early intervention types rather than offenders. In some cases, there's likely offenders, but generally it's just people who meet a profile that if we don't do something, they're going to be in trouble. And to see those kids walking into the first day of that program and then see them walking out after its completion, you just wouldn't believe it's the same group of kids.
Is there any more? So where did all our members go?
Don't you know?
They are not on us.
Because I'm ready to move this bill out of here.
Well, we got enough. What the heck?
I would be interested in this. Yeah, I think this is a good bill. Representative Ogun?
I'm very supportive of the concept. I feel that this would be a good thing to do for the reasons that Representative Porter recognized. I feel that young people lack a lot of young people, especially young people that are in trouble, have never had any real discipline in their lives, and I got my discipline in a different form of boot camp, but I nonetheless received a lot of positive discipline through a program in my youth, and my only concern is simply the fiscal note. Is there any proposals what we're going to eliminate to institute this program? Now, I ran on the premise that I believe that we need to prioritize our spending for public safety, road maintenance, education, and protect the natural resources, and I'd be willing to take a hard look at some other sources of funding for this within our state government. But if we're going to pass this bill and fund it as a legislature, we need to, before we do that, we need to really look at where we're going to get the money.
I guess if I could respond to that, and we'll hear what Representative Ivan has, and I agree totally with your comments here. I think that this committee basically's interest is whether this is good for the state or not. I think that if we can free up hard beds in our corrections that are overflowing, if we can cut down on recidivism, if we can do all those kinds of things. Those are some options. I think this is a tool that we might ought to have. I might say that if there is federal money available for building a facility, that's another whole issue. I'm sure it would be matching funds. We'd still have to put up some. But I'm very interested in contracting, and I think that contracting it out might be a real option, and I'm glad that that option is in here. So that's just my concerns. And of course, if the fiscal note is a drag, this will never get to the House floor. But I think that we really have to consider in this committee just exactly how this would affect the affairs of the state. Representative Ivan, you had a comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a good bill, but I do have, but I'm stuck with the fiscal note that I see. And where by today we're looking at where we can cut the budget today. And $5 million is a lot of money, but maybe down the road we'll have some information that would assure us that indeed this will be a cost saving. Have we looked at, with the military cutback in Alaska facilities coming up, has that been looked at as a possibility for a location?
I'm sure it has. And you know, one of the things that when we do have a bill such as this that puts an authorization on the books, and historically this has happened, and then it's not funded, you know, it's still the tool is there in the event that some mechanism of financing it arrives, or some private person comes out with this wonderful offer and doesn't really cost the state an awful lot of money. Those are all options. If the option isn't on the books, then we don't have the option. So that, you know, that's another reason why I think that it would be wise to move it out of this committee. Anyone else have any comments or questions on that? Representative Ogan.
One real quick comment, Madam Chair. I know you're anxious to get to the agenda today. I would like to see a program like this for our youthful defenders, I mean the juveniles. I know in Matanuska Valley, and I'm sure there's problems elsewhere, kids don't get arrested and face any ramifications for anything until their second felony or their first violent felony, any misdemeanors. The police just do not have the facilities to even take them downtown. They take them, they drop them off the parents' front porch. And these kids are getting a message that it's a free ride for any misdemeanor. And when they do get convicted of their first nonviolent felony, it's a 6 to 8 month wait to get into the probation officer. And then a probation officer in Palmer told me they get a warning letter because they're too busy to handle them. So I think we're missing, this is a good program, I think we're missing the boat here with these youthful offenders, because by the time they're learning early on that there's no ramifications for antisocial behavior, and these patterns are set in their lives. And I think the most cost-effective use would be to maybe get a program like this going for the juveniles rather than...
I would respond to that too, and that would also have a big fiscal note if we were to do that. You know, so I think that there would be some real advantage to that. I think those are some plans we have to do. Representative Porter.
Well, that need has been met. It's now been in place for 2 years, a year and a half. The National Guard program is demonstrating great success, and it takes kids from all over the state, not just Anchorage or Fairbanks or some other location. So I would suggest that regional probation officers and school officials would coordinate, if they haven't already been contacted by the program, for identification of likely candidates and try to start working on it.
First of all, we need to have a motion on the floor to use the CS number F, dated 3/16/95, as a working document.
I would so move.
That it's been moved that the CS numbered F, 3/16/95, is the working document. Is there any objection? Hearing none, then the CS is a working document. Somebody like to make a motion to move this bill out of committee with individual recommendations?
Madam Chair, may I make a comment?
Yes, please. You may.
I agree with the concept, and it's a good idea, and it's trying to make corrections as far as our people are concerned in the prison. But with the financial situation we're in, I will be forced to vote looking at the financial situation we're in today.
Thank you. Representative Robinson?
Well, I just very quickly want to respond to it. The facts are we're putting and have been putting more and more laws on the books to toughen the penalties regarding juveniles and adults, and that somewhere down the road, whether we like it or not, our facilities are crowded and we're going to have to make another alternative. So unless I'm missing something, whether we have a tight budget or not, down the road we're going to have to be probably building another facility. And I think this is a really good way for us to get this on the book, so that's at least an alternative that the department can look at. And it might even be, I mean, more cost effective once we get it in place. And so as much as I would like to think in this state that we wouldn't have to build one more facility or one more jail in the near future, I've got a feeling that that's not the reality. And I think this will be the best direction to go.
Madam Chair, if I might say one thing about, I think various committee members have touched on several things that are, in fact, sort of moving along in a way the department is looking at. Military facilities at Fort Rich and Fort Greeley that are possibilities, and I'm reluctant to talk about them simply because I don't want somebody to say, well, you said you were going to be able to do a certain thing, and at this point I don't know that I'm going to be able to do it, but we are looking at that. The federal government is providing a plane ticket for a representative from the Department of Health and Social Services and three people from the Department of Corrections to a training program the last weekend of this month, specifically having to do with boot camps and the funding that's related to boot camps. We hope to come back with probably not money in our pocket, but at least some real information about how we can pursue that. So both of those things, negotiations for perhaps some cheaper facilities that would significantly reduce the $5 million price tag that we put on this facility. We hope that we can do something about that. We also hope we can get some federal money. There's no doubt that, it seems likely to me that, yes, if we get federal money, there's going to be some matching required. I don't know what that would be, and I'd have a lot more information in another 10 days. But.
Thank you. So what's the wish of the committee?
Madam Chairman.
Yes, Representative Porter.
Since it always falls to the seat, I would ask and move with unanimous consent we move HB2 from committee with individual recommendations and whatever the current fiscal notes are.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, then the bill is moved.
Thank
Brian,
you, Madam Chair.
You just did a good job, though. You got it down.
Yeah, I do.
Why should any of us intervene?
House Bill 239.
Let's hear it for the mosquito.
What's really interesting is Anchorage and Fairbanks were voted highly for the mosquito. Mm-hmm.
Representative Nicolai, would you like to tell us about your bill?
Yes. House Bill 239 amends Alaska Statute 44.09 to designate the dragonfly as the official state insect. This suggestion was first brought to the attention of the legislature by a group of students from Aniak, Alaska. The students from Auntie Mary Nicolai Elementary School began requesting nominations for the official state insect in 1992. Along with a nomination for the dragonfly sponsored by both the Auntie Mary Nicolai students and the students at Murray Drake School in Juneau were nominations for the unmarked slender mosquito, the morning cloak butterfly, and the bumblebee. When the nomination process had come to a close, ballots were sent to every public school in the state. The results of the election were as follows. Four spots skimmer dragonfly, 3,941 votes. Unmarked slender mosquito, 3,073 votes. The morning cloak butterfly, 2,998 votes. Bumblebee, 1,492 votes. That's the four spot skimmer dragonfly won the nomination with an 868 vote margin. Many Alaskans may feel that the mosquito would be a more appropriate candidate for state insect, given the overwhelmingly large population of mosquitoes that inhabits our state during the summer months. However, upon further consideration of the matter, the dragonfly seems a more logical choice. First, the four-spot skimmer dragonfly is one of the many predators of the mosquitoes. Those of us who have spent many hours in the Alaskan wilderness can appreciate the importance of this fact. Not only does the dragonfly help with the population control of the state's most annoying pest, it is one of the largest insects in this, the largest state. The third, the dragonfly's ability to hover and fly forward and backward reminds us of the skillful maneuvering of the bush pilots in Alaska. Last of all, two large compound eyes allow the dragonfly to reflect the many facets of Alaskan life and the diversity that exists within our state. All of these factors make the dragonfly the most appropriate candidate for the category of official state insect. Please consider the recommendation of our young people and vote the four-spot skimmer dragonfly into this most worthy position. I strongly urge you to support this measure.
How could you argue with that?
Thank you, Representative Nicolai. We have on teleconference, and the computer's down today, but we have on teleconference from ANIAC 8 students and 1 teacher wishing to testify. I don't have their names, so I guess that what I would like to ask the teacher if she could arrange. Oh, I now suddenly have the names here.
The dragonfly brought it in.
So do we have Randy Deal?
Yo, Randy.
Do we have anybody?
A presentation that they would like to do?
Pardon? Would you repeat that statement?
Good morning. My name is Mrs. Bradford, and I am the teacher of the students, and they each have a short presentation as well as a history of our efforts to make the dragonfly the state insect. They can introduce themselves, and that way you'll know the pronunciation of their names. We realize that the legislature has many important concerns, but this bill represents a real grassroots effort by thousands of students across the state. We will take about 7 minutes in our presentation.
Go ahead and start anytime you're ready.
Hi, my name is Brooke Crisk. I'm in the seventh grade. The dragonfly has been around since prehistoric times. They outlived the dinosaurs, which shows that Alaska has a history of more than just snow and ice.
Hi, my name is Rainey Deal, and I am in the eighth grade. The dragonfly is quite unique because it is colorful and larger than most flying insects. Unfortunately, there are not enough to destroy all the mosquitoes in rural Alaska.
Hi, my name is David Deal. I'm in the sixth grade. I voted for the dragonfly because I don't like to see mosquitoes. During the summer in Alaska, it would be beautiful to be. It would be even better with fewer mosquitoes.
Hi, my name is Deidre Bush. I'm in the eighth grade. I fly high. I'm a four-spot skimmer dragonfly. Watch me soar through the sky. I represent Alaska because I'm an awesome guy. I'll eat mosquitoes till the day I die.
I like the mosquito, but it is a pest. I like the dragonfly. It eats a pest. Dragonflies represent Alaska the best.
Hi, my name is Andrew Gustin. I'm in the sixth grade. The dragonfly is long, slender, and graceful. It eats mosquitoes and was the choice of most Alaskan students. I believe the dragonfly deserves to be our state insect.
Hi, my name is Derek Blumey, and I'm in seventh grade. Winter in Alaska is cold. Any insect as big and beautiful as a dragonfly that can survive Alaska's cold deserves to be the state insect.
My name is Melanie Mandarin in the 5th grade. The committee and I worked hard on this project. We stuffed hundreds of votes of envelopes, counted votes, staked, earned money for postage, and a lobby team trip to Juneau. We are not about to stop working until the dragonfly is the official statement.
3 years ago, a group of NAX students under the direction of our teacher, Ruth Bradford, wrote letters to universities, colleges, and each school district in Alaska, asking for nominations for insects that would best represent all the areas of Alaska. 7 insects were nominated. These are the insects. Northern caddisfly, morning coast butterfly, mustard white butterfly, unmarked thunder mosquito, or spot skimmer dragonfly, feathered tartar shell butterfly, and the bumblebee.
2 years ago, we and the ex-students researched each insect and held a primary election in the 10 schools in the Cuspuck School District. The original field of 7 was narrowed to 4. Four-spot skimmer dragonfly, bumblebee, slender unmarked mosquito, and the morning cloak butterfly. The next step was to prepare packets containing ballots, information, and pictures of each insect, a ballot summary sheet, and return address. We earned $118 for postage to send the packets to each of the 167 public schools in Alaska, sent to each school in January 1994. As the ballots King Coy and art science teacher Leia Bradford direct the students to open the envelopes, read the comments, and tally the votes. We log the totals in notebook, cut out the return addresses, and paste them on a poster. Then we found the village on a live map of Alaska and marked it with a dot. The next step was making a huge ramp in the hall, displaying the votes as they came in. We wrote and performed the state insect draft, and sent the video to Kilo 13 News, encouraging students of Alaska to get their ballots sent to ANIAC. No matter how large or small the village or city or the geographical location of the school, students found a new interest in the importance of insects to life as it is in Alaska. They campaigned in their schools, studied the pros and cons of each nominee, and carried out the democratic process by expressing their choice at the vote. More than 11,000 students across the state are now waiting to see the final result that election. In September of this year, all the ANIAC students who had taken part in the state insect project over the years had a chance to apply for the Dragonfly Lucky Team. The applications included such questions as why the dragonfly should be Alaska state insect, and ideas for making money for the trip to Juneau. We are the eight students who were chosen by an impartial committee. Our team, along with friends, family, and the guidance of our teacher, Claudia Luria, have been busy baking, baffling, and selling popcorn balls, and donated articles to earn the necessary $6,000 to make the trip to Juneau in April to lobby for the bill. We, the members of the Dragonfly Lobby Team, are grateful to the people of ANIAC and the surrounding communities for their support. According to Dr. Mark Osgood, professor of aquatic biology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, quote, the dragonfly is an elegant organism. Its beauty puts it right in there with the butterflies. It is an incredible aerial acrobat. It probably lives more than 1 year in the larva stage and spends the winter in frozen mud. It emerges as an adult during the second summer, unquote. The fact that adult dragonflies have chewing mouthparts and feel in other flying insects, like mosquitoes, is perhaps the main reason for the dragonfly's victory over the slender, unmarked mosquito. It is a born hunter, a true Alaskan. It is now up to our legislators to vote for the bill and for our governor to sign it into law.
Can students make a difference in government? Yes. Can students make things happen in the real world? Yes. We are confident we will soon have a four-spot skimmer dragonfly adopted as the official Alaska state insect to prove that students can make changes using true Alaskan diligence.
Let's adopt a four-spot skimmer dragonfly for Alaska.
Great presentation.
Representative Porter.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I must admit, when I first read this bill, I was one of those guys that said, why not the mosquito? But I'll tell you, after being lobbied by the Dragonfly Lobby Team of ANIAC, I am persuaded and I am switching my vote.
Don't accept again.
Representative Olgan.
I have to associate myself with Brian Porter's comments. In fact, I had an amendment drafted here to delete dragonfly and insert mosquito, and I want you kids to know that I'm not going to pass this amendment, that I would hate to be accused of being a mean-spirited Republican. and you guys have convinced me, and you're doing a good job. You can make a difference.
Any other comments or questions? Yeah, I have a motion. Representative Green.
This one he makes.
I too am overwhelmed with the grit that these kids have shown, and I think we need to deserve they deserve that we would pass this out of committee.
their idea of how things happen in this whole process, and I think that whole exercise has probably been a real piece of education for them and for the teacher and for anyone else that was participating with them. And I thank you, Representative Nicolai, for bringing this bill to our attention. Representative Robinson?
I'm so convinced I want to be a, I want to sign up with
you.
Yeah. Okay, so is there any objection to moving this out?
Madam Chair?
Oh, right. We have a CS.
What?
And so we need to accept the CS first.
What?
The first one just said the dragonfly is the official state insect. The CS, the State Affairs CS, says the four-spot skimmer dragonfly is the official state insect.
Oh.
So we need to have a motion to accept the CS as a working document.
And point of order.
Yes.
Do we need to rescind
yes.
the first motion?
Yes.
I will
yes.
withdraw my
All
motion.
Right. Okay. Then let's have a motion to accept the CS.
I would move that we accept the CS version C, Charlie, dated 3/17/95 for HB 239.
Is there any objection? Then the CS is before us. And now, Representative Green. Representative Porter.
I just want to make sure. Do the kids want this?
Yeah, that's fine. Because okay. it states.
They want dragonfly.
The name.
So, yeah. Representative
Thank
Green.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I would move with unanimous consent that we would move House CS for House Bill 239, designated C, Bannister, 3/17/95, out of committee with individual recommendations.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Willis.
Perhaps the motion should say that we shoo the dragonfly.
Play like you didn't hear that.
Are there any objections? Then the bill is moved.
The kids got us laughing.
You have to be of a certain age to appreciate that.
Oh, that's true. No, we're not confusing that with the shoe fly pie, are we?
Oh, I hope not.
Where's the...
Oh, very good.
That's why we're all laughing in this committee.
That's true. It's probably just as well.
We shoo this bill.
Okay, they can laugh over this one.
Probably not.
This one may not be quite so humorous.
I'm sorry.
I don't remember us hearing this one before, but I guess...
We haven't.
That's why.
It didn't have a dot next to it, that's why.
Well, this is not the first committee referral.
Next item is House Bill 46, which is by Representative Green. And we have
additional information.
Mr. Logan, staff for Mr. Green, for Representative Green, sitting here. Would you tell us about your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make an attempt. Before I begin, Madam Chair, I'd like to make sure everybody has the right version of the bill. There was a technical problem, and if you have version K, it's the Labor and Commerce version K. If not, I have copies for everyone.
Please. Yeah, I think probably you might have.
Yeah.
We're still playing with KFF.
I got
G.
F. There's unfortunately there was a corrected version, and it was also in error.
Chosen by an impartial committee.
Our team, along with friends, family, and the guidance of our teacher, Claudia Lumia, have been busy baking, raffling, and selling popcorn balls, and donated articles to earn the necessary $6,000 to make the trip to Juneau in April to lobby for the bill. We, the members of the Dragonfly Lobby Team, are grateful to the people of Aniak and the surrounding communities for their support. According to Dr. Mark Osgood, professor of aquatic biology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, quote, the dragonfly is an elegant organism. Its beauty puts it right in there with the butterflies. It is an incredible aerial acrobat. It probably lives more than 1 year in a larva stage and spends the winter in frozen mud. It emerges as an adult during the second summer, unquote. The fact that adult dragonflies have chewing mouthparts and feel and other flying insects, like mosquitoes, is perhaps the main reason for the dragonfly's victory over the slender, unmarked mosquito. It is a born hunter, a true Alaskan. It is now up to our legislators to vote for the bill and for our governor to sign it into law.
Can students make a difference in the state government? Yes. Can students make things happen in the real world? Yes. We are confident we will soon have an four-spot skimmer dragonfly adopted as the official Alaska state insect to prove that students can make changes using true Alaskan diligence.
Let's adopt a four-spot skimmer dragonfly for Alaska.
Great presentation.
Representative Porter.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I must admit, when I first read this bill, I was one of those guys that said, why not the mosquito? But I'll tell you, after being lobbied by the Dragonfly Lobby Team of Aniak, I am persuaded, and I am switching my vote.
Don't accept again.
Representative Olgan.
I have to associate myself with Brian Porter's comments. In fact, I had amendment drafted here to delete dragonfly and insert mosquito, and I want you kids to know that I'm not going to pass this amendment, that I would hate to be accused of being a mean-spirited Republican. And you guys have convinced me, and you're doing a good job. You can make a difference.
Any other comments or questions? Yeah, I have a motion. Representative Green.
This one he makes.
I too am overwhelmed with the grit that these kids have shown, and I think we need to deserve they deserve that we would pass this out of committee.
Idea of how things happen in this whole process, and I think that whole exercise has probably been a real piece of education for them and for the teacher and for anyone else that was participating with them. And I thank you, Representative Nicolai, for bringing this bill to our attention. Representative Robinson?
I'm so convinced I want to be a I want to sign up with you.
That's a real,
yeah. Okay, so is there any objection to moving this out?
Madam Chair?
Oh, right. We have a CS. And
CS.
We need to accept the CS first.
What?
The first one just said the dragonfly is the official state insect. The CS, the State Affairs CS, says the four-spot skimmer dragonfly is the official state insect.
Oh.
So we need to have a motion to accept the CS as a working document.
At the point of order.
Yes.
Do we need to rescind
yes.
the first one?
Yes.
I will
yes.
withdraw my
All
motion.
Right. Okay. Then let's have a motion to accept the CS.
I would move that we accept the CS version C, Charlie, dated 3/17/95 for HB 239.
Is there any objection? Then the CS is before us, and now Representative Green. Representative Porter.
I just want to make sure. Do the kids want this?
Yeah, that's fine, because it states...
They want Dragonfly.
The name.
Representative
Thank
Green.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I would move with unanimous consent that we would move House CS for House Bill 239, designated C, Bannister, 3/17/95, out of committee with individual recommendations.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Willis.
Perhaps the motion should say that we shoo the dragonfly.
Play like you didn't hear that.
Are there any objections? Then the bill is moved.
And the kids got us laughing.
You have to be of a certain age to appreciate that.
Oh, that's true. No, we're not confusing that with the shoe fly pie, are we?
I hope not.
Where's the...
Oh, very good.
That's we're all laughing in this committee.
That's true. It's probably just as well.
We shoo this bill.
They can laugh over this one.
Probably not.
This one may not be quite so humorous.
I'm sorry.
I don't remember us hearing this one before, but I guess...
We haven't.
That's why.
It didn't have a dot next to it. That's why.
Well, this is not the first committee referral.
Next item is House Bill 46, which is by Representative Green. And we have
additional information.
Mr. Logan, staff for Mr. Green, for Representative Green, sitting here. Would you tell us about your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make an attempt. Before I begin, Madam Chair, I'd like to make sure everybody has the right version of the bill. There was a technical problem, and if you have version K, it's the Labor and Commerce version K. If not, I have copies for everyone.
Yeah, I think probably you might have. If we're still playing with K, F, F. G,
F. There's a. Unfortunately, there was a corrected version, and it was also in error. Does everybody have one on this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank
you. Have one. Anybody doesn't?
I think.
Here to see him.
Yeah.
Okay, Madam Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to introduce the committee HB 46. My name is Jeff Logan. I am legislative assistant to Representative Joe Green, who is the prime sponsor of this legislation. I'd like to just go through the bill through the first, there's three sections, go through the sections and give the committee some idea of what we're trying to do here, and then go into questions, if that's okay with you.
Go ahead.
Section 1 deals with where, when a document has to be sealed. We're dealing here with registered engineers, architects, and land surveyors putting their stamp on a document. We have rewritten this section in a more active case to fit in better, I guess, for lack of a better way to say it, with the rest of the section. You may hear testimony that there is a substantive difference in our language and the language that we are deleting. We don't necessarily believe that's true. If you read the new language, it makes it more clear when a registrant has to stamp or seal a document, and that was our intent, was to clarify that. Section 2 of the bill is the prohibited practice section. This section was included in the bill at the request of a constituent who saw that there was a conflict in the statutes between 48.281 and 48.331. When the Department of Commerce, Division of Occupational Licensing inspectors or investigators found a person who was not in compliance because of the conflict in the statutes, there was difficulty motivating the Department of Law to prosecute those cases, because there is a loophole here. This section attempts to close that loophole by inserting that, or deleting rather, the word a registered, the words "registered," which then makes the language read that not only can you not do this if you are a registered engineer, you have to be just an engineer to be able to say you're an engineer. This third section is probably the most, it's the meat of the bill, I'm sure. It reinserts an exemption from the requirements of the chapter. This is a section of the bill that was deleted in 1990. Up until that time, this exemption existed. In 1990, it was removed. Since the removal, it has become apparent to the sponsors that a lot of people, a lot of companies, and overall a lot of Alaskans depend on and need this exemption. When the exemption was removed, I've listened to the entire public record, the tapes, read the minutes. When it was removed, no members of the public testified at the hearing. It was a public hearing. It was duly noted. The title of the bill contained the words removing an exemption. But for whatever reason, representatives of those parties that have been affected by this, whether they had hearings somewhere else, didn't recognize what the bill did, for whatever reason, they were not there to testify. And as it turns out, it affects a great number of Alaskans, as I said, a great deal. And because it does, we're attempting in the bill to reinsert it. What it does, it says that if you work for a company and that company does some engineering services, you don't have to be a registered engineer. So for large companies, for utilities that have engineers on staff that are doing work, engineering work, they don't necessarily have to be registered engineers. And you'll hear comments today on both sides of this. I think will be persuasive that it's a very important piece of language to reinsert back into our statutes.
Representative Green.
Madam Speaker, before we get into any questions and into the teleconferencing, I think it's appropriate under Section 2, there may have been a slight misunderstanding that the reason a registered was dropped was, in fact, an attempt to tighten the legislation that says that you not only cannot profess that you are a registered engineer unless you're registered, you cannot profess that you are an engineer for hire by the public without even saying I'm a registered engineer, I'm just an engineer for hire unless you're registered by the deletion here. And that was the intent, was to tighten it up rather than to, so just so that everybody understands what originally was intended.
Representative Robinson.
Just real quickly, just because we are going through the bill right now. When you did the research on the record, what was the reason for removing it? I mean,
Madam Chair, Representative Robinson, the reason given was that the language was too broad, and there was a testimony by occupational licensing that there had been a case where a bank, a large company that had engineers on staff, had attempted to build a building of their own, coming to the state saying, we're exempted, this engineer is not registered but works in our company. Whether the building was ever built, I don't know, but it bothered them at that time, and that was the only indication I got from the tape of why they, there were several statements that it was too broad, but no examples of cases that were a problem.
Any other questions or comments? We have a couple people on the teleconference. In Anchorage, do we have someone in Anchorage want to testify on HB 46? I don't have a name.
Yes, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I have six people here that want to testify on House Bill 46.
Okay, and I don't have those names, so when they give their names, they'll have to be very careful that they're spelled properly, and I'll let you just have them get in order. And let's try to confine the testimony to about two minutes or so.
Thank you. First one on the list is Dave Bennett from PTI.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Bennett.
Yes, Madam Chairman.
Please state your name, address, and phone number.
Yes. David L. Bennett, 3940 Arctic Boulevard, Anchorage, 907-564-3005.
Go ahead.
We at PTI and the customers that we serve have a vested interest in this legislation. We are in the business of designing our own telecommunications infrastructure to serve our customers. We're not in the business of designing utility systems for other utilities or for the public. To our knowledge, there has been no history of any public safety issues related to telecommunications utility system design.
Yeah, thank you. Do you support the bill or not?
We support the bill. We prefer the original 1990 language, but we do support it as it is.
Okay, you do have. Do you have a copy of this this K version?
We do. I do not have the K version. I believe it's the G version.
Okay, maybe. Do we have a fax number to get those people so they have a copy of what we're talking about?
It's on his way.
Okay. Let's go ahead and hear the next person. Thank you.
Jim Rowe.
Madam Chair, my name is Jim Rowe, R-O-W-E. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Telephone Association. I want to thank you for this opportunity to address the committee. I'm representing 22 local exchange companies in the state of Alaska that deliver local telephone service. We are very interested in the passage of this bill into legislation. The exception that was taken out in 1990, as Mr. Logan has indicated, was done certainly without our knowledge, without most knowledge of virtually everybody I've talked to. I think one real key issue was taken out not due to any public outcry. Nobody was asking for protection. There was no indication that there was any substandard building, certainly not in the utility industry. We had only somebody with a vested interest evidently there who had an opportunity to bring more work under their jurisdiction. We do build completely to national safety standards, to national building standards put out by AT&T, General Telephone, Contel, the Rural Electric Administration. As we borrow money, we must build to these standards. They're historically sound. They're historically tested. They are looked on by experts in the telecommunications business. They're used all over the United States. We do follow these. We don't feel that there is need for a public seal from a PE in the state of Alaska to make these standards any better. They are historically good. As a liability issue, the company, the utility, is certainly competent to stand liable for any damage that it does do, and in history has not done at all. We do appreciate Representative Green taking this issue for us. It is very important not only to our companies, but to our customers. They're the ones that are going to be charged by any additional burden that is put on. And the removal of this in 1990 has indeed put an additional burden on us. I will say that we have not been in compliance. We didn't know for at least 2 years that we're out of compliance until we received a letter from the Department of Occupational Regulation. We don't have the capability to be in compliance, and that there are very few PEs versed in telecommunications in this state. And we have other people who testify to that as well. I want to thank this committee for looking at this issue. I appreciate your sound consideration for your constituents who will have to pay for this if it is not reenacted. And I'm available for questions, Madam Chair.
Mr. Rowe, could you give us your address and phone number?
I'm sorry, I certainly can. It is 4341 B Street, Suite 304,
Anchorage, Alaska, 99503. My phone number is 563-4000.
Thank you very much. And would you put the next person on, please?
Next is George Findling from Marco.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name for the record is George Findling. I'm the manager of government relations for Arco, Alaska. My address is box 100-360, Anchorage, Alaska, 99501. My telephone number is 263-4174. We don't have this version, King, in front of us, but from what I understand it to be, we do support the committee substitute for HB 46. I want to cover two very quick points for you, Madam Chairman. Given occupational licensing in the context of our business, we find that Section 1 of HB 43 is a technical clarification to the existing law. To us, the issue was brought into focus when the existing statute was converted to active voice as required by the Manual of Legislative Drafting. The new wording of Section 1 is in the active voice, and it defines who is to do what the statute seeks to have done. But we find that when viewed in this context and the rest of the section, that it must be telling the registrant what to do. Under this interpretation and looking at the broader context of statewide activities, the parties we've been talking to agreed it might be appropriate to request an expedited opinion from either legislative or administrative attorneys on whether Section 1 changes existing statute or not. And I would respectfully suggest that the committee might want to pursue such an opinion. Secondly, basically, my testimony is not quite for K. Let me modify it here. In the case of a general exemption, we have, of course, been on record as supporting that. As background, 37 other states also have broad exemptions. Indeed, when Alaska had a general exemption prior to 1990, we saw no major disbenefits from that. I, too, have listened to the tapes of the hearing and saw no reason for that change in 1990. Clearly, not restoring this exemption will raise costs and reduce Alaska's competitiveness. Let me say quickly that ARCO is in no way trying to avoid meeting legitimate safety concerns. We are already a very highly regulated industry. In all its discussions, no one has identified any specific concerns with our operations. But if there are any, we can and will address them through agencies that regulate that activity. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you very much. And with the next person.
Colin Maynard with the Alaska Professional Design Council.
My name is Colin Maynard. My address is 1400 West Benson, Suite 500, 99503. My phone number is 274-3660. I represent the Alaska Professional Design Council, which is an organization of approximately 11 professional engineering, architectural, land surveying, and code official organizations. Which have a membership of about 1,200 licensed professionals. Over the past week, I and other individuals from the engineering community have been meeting with representatives of the oil, telephone, and cable television industries to see if we could come to a compromise on this bill. After about 6 hours of meetings and several more hours of additional work, Dave Adams and I have prepared a memo, which you should have a copy of. And I think there's now general agreement that this approach is an acceptable middle ground for all the parties. What it would do is allow specific industries to be exempted rather than giving the broad exemption that would have existed prior to 1990. The reason it was removed in 1990 was because of its broad nature. Sticking it back in again does not solve the problem. What we would do is exempt industries where there is not a public safety issue, and then allow the board to exempt other industries as necessary where public safety is not at risk. That was the intent, I believe, in 1990 for that to happen, was for the board to exempt public safety issues or non-public safety issues out from under the registration. As a matter of fact, electrical utilities went through that last fall, and by regulation, some of their work was exempted from the licensure requirement. In the memo, Section 3 is the exact wording of those regulations. The wording regarding telecommunications industry is a mirror of that. And from what I understand, our main bone of contention is whether a licensed professional from the state of Alaska would need to go ahead and reapprove REE standards. The telecommunications industry thinks that's unnecessary. We believe that somebody who knows the local conditions should review those standards. Classic example of failures are telephone poles that get jacked out of the ground. And we would hope that you would amended to go along with what the intent was in 1990.
Thank you. Could we hear the next person, please?
Next is David Adams with Adams Morgan Hunter Company.
Yes, my name is Dave Adams. It's Adams Morgan Thaler and Company, 3333 Denali, Suite 100, Anchorage 99503, telephone 279-0431. I represent an engineering firm of about 27 people. I'd like to first point out that the testimony that Colin Maynard and myself are greatly outnumbered. We're here on our own time. Everyone else is testifying on the other side of this issue is being paid to be here. So I hope in your evaluation of this that you'll give some credit to Colin's standing and representation of over 1,200 people. In 1990, the exemption was deleted because it was overbroad. The NELS statute provides accountability for performance. And removing the exemption entirely was too sweeping of a change. We agree with the oil companies and with the telecommunication industries that they need relief. And we've been spending a lot of time over the last few days to try to provide relief. The language provided to you by our volunteer committee provides the exemptions that are not overbroad, but will allow highly regulated and accountable companies, such as the oil companies and the utilities, to practice in their customary fashion. We believe that the wording we provided responsibly meets the needs of these industries without creating a major loophole in the AELS Act. Some argue that compliance with codes and standards will protect the public and workers. However, the court system disagrees with this because it's well established that designs that meet all codes but still result in any form of harm will bring legal action against the person that prepared that design. In the case of the AELS Act, when a person applies their seal to the documents, they become personally accountable. There's no corporate veil of protection. You bet the farm, you bet your house, you bet the mortgage, when you put your seal on a set of drawings. It's the only accountability that is in the system to protect the public. And while we, again, are for an exemption for oil and for the telecommunications industry, we think that a sweeping change that removes accountability from the system is reckless. Regulators look to the AELS Act to determine what they should do. Regulators are going to see budget cuts in the future that will limit their ability to enforce the licensing and design quality. Accountability is a necessary ingredient in public safety. But to wrap up, accountability must be preserved. Limited, focused exemptions are certainly a matter. The AE industry agrees with this, and we've attempted to accommodate these gentlemen, and I'm grateful that they've taken the time to meet with us to try to work this out. Businesses seeking an exemption are asking for changes that have to bring back an exemption that has been already deemed previously in 1990 to be overbroad. We cannot feel that the additional scope of the exemption in the current language of the bill, feel that the language expands the exemption unnecessarily.
Thank you. Is that all of the people in Anchorage?
No, there's one more.
Could I ask him to hold up for just a moment? We have a representative on the committee that has to leave shortly and wants to give some testimony before he leaves. So we'll take that one before we come back to the teleconference. Representative Olgan.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, for extending that courtesy to me. I just wanted to speak. I have some reservations with this bill. I think that I concur that the exemptions are a little too broad. And that certain utilities and maybe some in-house engineering and oil companies and things like that might be appropriate, but I have some serious reservations with architects and electrical engineers and this type of thing being exempted. And having said that, I hope you'll take those considerations when you vote. I got to run.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Now we'll go back and take that testimony from the one left in Anchorage.
Okay, that's Doyle Carroll with
AEU.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Doyle Carroll, C-A-R-R-O-L-L, with the Anchorage Telephone Utility at 600 Telephone Avenue, Anchorage, Alaska, 99503. Like Mr. Bennett testified for PTI, ATU also designs its network for its customers, and we do not offer our engineering services to the general public. Like most phone companies, ATU uses only equipment and its network that's type accepted by the Federal Communications Commission, and our network is designed in accordance with industry accepted specifications, i.e. AT&T practices, no corporate guidelines, what have you. And it is also done in conformance with the National Electrical Safety Code. Most of our network is primarily low voltage, i.e. 48 volts. There is some use of 130 volts, but for the most part, it's very low voltage. I estimate that the engineers on our staff have an average of 15 years experience or more. And to my knowledge, ATU has had no incidents where the design of its network has resulted in any unsafe condition or caused harm to any individual or company, nor have any such incidents been alleged. ATU became very concerned when we were made aware of change in the law about the availability of professional engineers with experience in the field of telecom plant construction. We have been recruiting for the last 6 to 8 weeks, and to this point, I have only 2 applications from individuals who have professional engineer registrations. One of those is from the state of Florida, and the other one is from the state of Alaska. Given that we have at least 15 engineers, or probably closer to 20, just in the outside plant arena, we would be hard-pressed to find professional engineers to replace those. So that's about the end of my comments, and ATU would support the bill as it exists.
Thank you very much. And now we can go to Fairbanks. We have some people there that want to testify on House Bill 46.
Yes. This is William Mendenhall, address 1907 Yankovich Road, Fairbanks 99709, phone number 479-2786. I'm speaking in opposition to this bill. Incidentally, I am a member of the Alaska State Board of Registration for Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors, but I'm speaking not for the board, only for myself at this time. I'd like mostly to concentrate on the very last part of the bill, Section 10, which allows exemptions. And it said that basically, unless you are offering your services to the public, you don't have to be registered. And then it further states that you can basically design anything you want as long as it does not involve the design or construction of a structure with walls and a roof. It means that anybody can design a bridge, a pipeline, a dam, and almost anything else without being registered. And I don't think that's a very good idea. I think this is too broad. In the past, we have worked quite closely, the board has worked quite closely with people in the power industry to come up with what should and should not require registration. And we frankly said that anything with low voltage does not require registration. Anything with a high voltage or a complex of work does require registration. And we also exempted things that meet standard codes, such as the REA code. I think the board could work with some private industries in here and try and get some exemptions. But this bill, I don't think is good. We if a large corporation, such as a pipeline company or some large telephone utility company, we're not asking that every individual be registered, only that somebody who assumes charge is registered. I'll summarize by saying that I oppose House Bill 46 as written.
Thank you. Is there anyone else left in Fairbanks to talk?
That's all for Fairbanks. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else out on the teleconference wishing to testify on this bill that I haven't called?
Yes, this is Soldatna.
Go ahead, sir.
My name is Mike Taurianen, Taurianen, Box 937, Soldatna, 262-4624. And I'm a registered engineer in Alaska since 1973, and I've been on the AELS board since 1991. I, however, am speaking as an individual and not representing the board. So my comments would have paralleled Mr. Mendenhall's, who just testified, and so I'll cut that part short, but I wanted to express a little bit of frustration that I'm working from a version B of this bill and don't have a clue as to what's contained in later versions other than some inferences by previous speakers. And so I may be completely out of sync with what is currently being proposed.
Sir, do you have a fax there that we could fax you a copy?
Yes, and I was going to ask if it could be faxed to 262-1881. That's the local LIO office. And if I could get a copy of that, and maybe the Adams and Maynard memo that was being referenced as well. And I would like the opportunity to be able to present some testimony after reviewing that, if the opportunity were to present itself. And but I still have some other comments in general on this.
I need to have your phone number, too. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I ask you before I forget.
Okay, the LIO phone number here?
Your personal phone number.
My office phone number is 262-4624.
Thank you. Now go ahead.
Okay. Very little testimony has been offered regarding Section 2. I presume that is still the same. Representative Green offered a comment on that previously, and with the intent that the dropping of registered before the terms architect, engineer, land surveyor was so that an person couldn't call themselves an engineer for hire to the public. I don't have a problem with that, but the way it's written right now, a person could not be an engineer for an oil company or anyone and call himself an engineer if he happens to be one, but not registered. And I think that's unnecessarily strict, and I'd like that section to remain as is until such time as better language could be worked out. The ADLS board did take action opposing the proposed language at its February meeting in Juneau. Then on Section 3, as I currently have it, I think that it's being rushed, and we're going to wind up with some bad legislation. We need to have some of the exemptions that are being requested and talked about. I'm in favor of those, but not the way it's currently written, or as I have it written, in a B version. And I'm in favor of minimal regulation, and would like to see us minimize our regulation rather than increase it. So I do favor some exemptions. But I would like to see the board, the ADLS board, be given some latitude, perhaps in statute, to facilitate those exemptions and work through the language as we did with the electrical utilities about a year ago. That's in essence what I have for now, but I would like to comment later after I see what the revised proposed version is.
We have that fax coming to you, sir, and also the letter from Colin Maynard with those suggestions. So is there anyone else out there on the teleconference line that has wanted to testify and have not called upon yet? Then is there anyone that is in the audience here that wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, then Mr. Logan, would you like to respond?
Madam Chair, thank you. The first thing I would like to do for those on the teleconference system that may not have version K is to explain the difference between a version they may have and a version K.
All right.
And it's very simple. It's only at the end of the bill, the very last sentence of the bill. The version K ends with the word public. The language that some people on the teleconference system may be looking at is version G, which continues on line 28. And if the engineering does not involve the design or construction of a structure with walls and a roof, that is a technical error that was included in the bill. And so on line 28 of version G, put a period after public, and that's version K.
Yeah, just that. Okay, is there any questions or comments by the committee? Representative Porter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Having heard this bill now for the second time, first in Labor and Commerce, during the discussion in that committee, there was the two different positions that we've heard was discussed, and I kind of got the impression that it came down to a consideration of the non-registered engineers or architects, the concern for them actually designing and constructing buildings that would be open to the public. And at the same time, I didn't get the impression that any of the people who were asking for this exemption to be replaced were interested in doing those kinds of things. So it's my understanding that Representative Green has an amendment that reflects that, and I would be very supportive of that. And also, I guess, just for the record, indicate that from a standpoint of public safety and responsibility, the concern for differentiating between a professional registered engineer or architect who provides a service to someone else as an independent person, independent entrepreneur, the registration is appropriate so that responsibility for that function can be established. The in-house employee who provides these kinds of services, albeit specialized and technical, that probably aren't appropriately assessed in a registration function anyway, with the state, the responsibility for those acts falls directly on the employer, and so there is coverage. That is the distinct difference in terms of public safety. So I have no concern about leaving the public hanging out because of non-registration in these situations where they are in-house people.
Any Representative Robinson?
I'm leaning very strongly in favor of this bill, but I'm just wondering, we have another amendment. This is, for me, the first time I've seen it. Makes a lot of sense, you know, to me, the interest in seeing the amendment. I do have concerns about, unfortunately, some of the people who are obviously strongly against this bill, which is, of course, our, if I understand, I guess it's our Architectural Engineering Board of the state, didn't have all the language in front of them first. So I'm kind of wondering what's, you know, your intent here, and I guess I'm kind of hoping that, I don't know if we're going to meet again on Saturday, but that we would be, the sponsor would be willing to give it a little bit longer, since this, if I'm correct, this is the last referral before it would go to the floor. I mean, I realize we have rules, but the last real public hearing, and so I'm just kind of curious about where we're at. I feel like I still need a little bit more information, even though I'm strongly leaning toward being in favor.
Representative Green.
thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chairman. To that end, we do have a proposed amendment to attempt to try and bring to closure this controversial subsection 10, and I would like that you'd have that if it is the will of the committee to hold this over. The concern we have, we're sympathetic to what we've heard from the AELS, but their supposed suggestion to amend, as was stated, includes a couple of pages of regulations which I think go the other way. The pendulum swings to the point that now you're putting into statute things I think better left to regulations, to the point of size of wire and that sort of thing. I think that's far too much. So what I would like to do is offer an amendment to subsection 10 and see what the will of the committee is from
that
point.
You have those copies of that amendment?
Well, we have a copy as it was intended, and there is a modification to that. You have been submitted copies.
We do?
No, they don't.
Oh, they haven't. I'm sorry. We have copies for you. I'm sorry.
All right.
Is the CS in front of us?
No, the CS is not in front of us.
Madam Chairman, I would move that we adopt CS for HB 46 version K kilo.
Is there any objection, Representative Robinson? No. Okay, then CS
Jeff, let's just get
number K is in front of us as a working document. Representative Robinson, you have a question.
Well, if we're going to be dealing with these amendments, I'm wondering if we also need to try to get them faxed off to the LIO offices, too, so that I don't know if you're going to hear back from these people who are getting a copy of the bill. or if we're going to make a decision here up front to hold the bill until either Saturday or next Tuesday. But I think it's pretty important that they also get this next amendment so that they know what we're talking about, too. I mean, we may can bring them on line here and be
Well, in response to that, it looks like, after looking at it, I hadn't wanted to see it, what the amendment looked like, but it looks like it's fairly simple to point out, since it's only one paragraph at the end of the bill.
Sure.
And if you might speak to that, I guess we need a motion to for the amendment, and then we'll speak to it. Representative Green?
If I may, this was prepared in advance of this meeting, and hearing the input from the AELS, I have taken the liberty to modify this with a sentence
Okay, well, let's have you tell us what your modification is before you move the bill.
Yes.
I mean, before you move the amendment.
Right.
Madam Chair, first of all, I'd like to note for the record that amendment number 3 has been faxed to the Anchorage LIO.
Okay.
The people on, I didn't know there was people in Fairbanks.
Fairbanks and Soldotna.
It's going there now.
It's going there now.
It's okay. In Anchorage, and it would be amendment number 3, Madam Chair, for those in Anchorage. And the amendment is as follows. On the first, second, third, fourth line, after the word only, insert the words "and further."
I've lost you.
Right after the word "only," a comma.
No, put "and further" right
oh,
there.
Oh, okay, I found it.
It's right here. No, on this one.
Okay, that's the only modification. That you
no,
have.
Madam Chair.
Okay, all right.
At the very end of the bill, after the word "public,"
uh-huh.
Make that period a comma, and then we'll say exclusion. Oh, you want a period? Okay, exclusion period.
No, period. Public period and then exclusion.
Okay, public period, then exclusion. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Exclusion under this subsection. Do not apply
exclusions.
Yes. It probably is hard to read. Exclusions. I'm sorry. You want me to read that? No wonder he had trouble. Exclusions under this subsection do not apply to buildings or structures whose primary use is public occupancy.
Okay, let me just quickly, before we go any further, let me talk to Soldotna. The person in Soldotna, do you have a copy of it?